thing with Larry Kelly at LarryKelly.com. Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. You got to be a man. You got to be a woman. You got to get back in there and read your history, because looks like it's coming back around boomerang style. This book is about us. I want to discuss with Larry Kelly Immutable Law Number 10 after hearing about his influence in skateboard design. A mile-long wave, and he surfed it. Wow, that's unbelievable. And then he came up with this. This work indicates that history was very important to Larry Kelly. And just looking at the bibliography and looking at all the detail inside this book, it's no wonder that it took about a decade to put it together, and it's well worth your investigation. So we'll be back with Larry Kelly in just a moment. Thanks for being with us again. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, Larry Kelly with Kelly with two E's. I keep saying that because I want to make sure if they go to your site, LarryKelly.com, that they're not going. It's not coming up. It's like, no, it needs another E, K-E-L-L-E-Y.
Thanks, John.
Say, let's lighten up for just a second here, and I want to hear about your influence in early skateboard design.
I actually made skateboards from parts before there was a commercial model. Kind of dating
Excellent.
Myself, I guess. But, you know, I remember finding in a dumpster a woman's indoor skate that had rubber wheels on it. Prior to that, it was, you know, the old skateboard or skates with that were metal wheels. And I remember... you know, making various models and designs and so forth. And then when the first skateboard came out, it was made by Hobie, the surfboard and sailboat maker. And boy, I could ride. Because I had learned on just worst equipment known to man. And so, I still skateboard and enjoy it. I have a little route. I take my dog out, and we at certain spots, I've got her on the leash, where we level off. I get on the board, and she takes off like a just bat out of hell. She starts sprinting. This is a border collie, and people see me coming, and I'm like a, you know, like a water skier behind the dog on my skateboard. And the people people are looking at me and they're pointing, and then as I go by, they say, "Hey, that's not a kid either. Wow."
You know, learning on the worst equipment on earth is really good because, you know, I learned my driving in stuff that wouldn't turn or stop very well without applying lots of power and cranking that wheel over. It's amazing we survived it all. Those early skateboards and even roller skates were highly dangerous.
Yeah, I know.
It's no wonder everybody liked roller derby because they were not only skating on dangerous skates, but they're also beating each other up. I mean, it was amazing barbarity.
Good sport.
Really good stuff. Let's go to Immutable Law Number 10. You know, we've been hearing about how the Navy is... I mean, there was an article. I was trying to find it. It's just lost in a sea of articles. I'll see if I can pull it up. It's probably not necessary. But the Navy is like being destroyed by these cutbacks, and the Raptor got canceled and all this. And it says right here, Immutable Law Number 10, declining civilizations will always face superior firepower from ascending civilizations because sovereignty is only temporarily uncontested.
Yeah.
That's worrisome because that's what's happening to us.
Right. People ask me, they say, sometimes they say, you know, you're writing a book, what's the title? I tell them the title. And then they say something to the effect, are we doomed? In my reading of history, you cannot have a world-class welfare state and a world-class military. You might have neither, but you can't have both.
Mm. That's pretty strong. It really is. And China is rising and has been.
Yeah, and Europe has been declining for a long time and
yes.
has no real means to defend itself, but they'd be speaking Russian there if it weren't for us during the Cold War. So, you know, that's the other reason why we have to see if we can become a solvent country again.
Now, you already said that you keep a positive view. You keep a hopeful view that some of this can be turned around. Maybe the whole thing can be turned around. But doesn't it suggest to you, even at the height of your optimism, that because these cycles have repeated so many times in almost the identical manner, that we're just going to have to ride through another one and see what happens on the other side?
I haven't made a determination, but one of the reasons I wrote the book is my wife calls me an insufferable alarmist.
An insufferable alarmist?
That's what I am, yeah.
Me too. You know, people have sort of been calling me an insufferable alarmist. No, not really. But yeah, a few of them have, actually. This is an interesting email. I just want to get your take on it. Janine writes, the ladies again. I'm telling you, the ladies are on it. The ladies are on it. I think in some ways more intensely than the guys are. I really mean that. She writes, the reason for disparity between 70% believing we're headed the wrong direction and the approval rating is simple. It's the skill of the professional con man and the ignorance/illiteracy of the majority of the people. Leadership says very conservative things in an ambiguous way, then does the opposite, and then blames the bad results on someone else. And we do not have two parties, but fraternal twins with the same basic objections who know they are in opposition to the will of the people and don't care. Both have gone over to the dark side. I just kind of went,
The preamble particularly is very, very good. I couldn't agree with that. I think that there are those in Congress. What I would respond to her, what her name is?
Janine.
I would say that there are those in Congress that will go along no matter what letter comes after their name. But there are a significant number of people, and those also, and also governors in various states that have are fiscally responsible, and there are governors with particularly that have states that are solvent. So that's the only thing I disagree with in what she said. I wish that Bush had George Bush during his tenure had been a little more careful, maybe is the proper word, with allowing the government to grow on its own too much. He added to the entitlements, the Medicare drug benefit. I don't think he should have done that. So I'm agreeing and somewhat disagreeing as well.
Yeah. Well, he also put together the Department of Homeland Security that's acquiring so much ammunition and firearms that it's got a lot of people alarmed as to what the possible use for these things might be.
Yeah.
That's true,
but on the other side of the coin, John, I would say this. Imagine on September 12th, 2001, after the attack, the day after the attacks, would you have imagined that we would not have another attack on the mainland for the entire two terms of President Bush?
I would have thought so. In fact, I didn't think that the holy grail of terrorism, the briefcase nuke, might not have gone off at some point. I mean, it was just all bets were off. Anything was possible.
So, there's truth to what she's saying, and I just disagree in this and part of just the last part of partially.
Okay, I get it. Well, that's okay. I mean, opinions and beliefs are very, very closely related. You know what I mean?
True. But I love. I don't forgotten who said this. It might have been Reagan. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't. But you are entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Well, yeah. Now that's an extraordinarily good point.
There were no attacks. There were no further attacks.
Yeah, and you know, to us.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I interrupted you. You finish. I'll jump in. We've been stepping on each other all night. No reason to stop now, you know.
That's really all I wanted to say. I thought that, and I have it in the book. By the way, the final third of the book, I tell you, I show you that the history of the rise of militant Islam and where we are with respect to the war against it, and they have declared war against us. Make no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And so I give you the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, which really gave birth to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And you'll also learn about the role that Iran plays in Islamic terrorism.
You know, we've had people come on the program and say that they really don't think that Iran wants to throw down. That's the expression that I've decided is the cliche of the week. And others have come on saying, oh, they most definitely want to throw down. Don't make any mistake about that. And then somebody else will come on and present an argument.
I'm sorry.
Well, get it on. Start a war. Oh, get right. into it. Let's mm-hmm. do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe drag some other countries, maybe even China and Russia into it. Something and anything. I mean, and others say, no, it's not that they want to drag China and Russia into it unless it's in furtherance of destroying the United States. What they really want to do is they just want to spread Islam. That's the government. The people don't necessarily go along with this, but the government does. And you know, you just hear everything, you know. And,
that is correct. The when 9/11, when that the attacks were going out around the world, was the most publicized event in human history. The in most of the Middle Eastern capitals, Cairo, Damascus, the people were celebrating. In Tehran, the people held a candlelight vigil, and the government attempted to shut it down and couldn't. The average Iranian is a younger person. They lost a lot of people in the Iran-Iraq war. There was kind of a generation, an older generation, they got shorn away. The casualties were so big. But most of the people under 30, under 35,
yes,
are sick of this theocratic regime.
Every Persian that I talk to, every Iranian that I speak to, I call them Persians. They say the same thing.
They want this regime to go away, to end. And they are not. They do not side with them. And so. And I just happen to know that because I have done some articles with a woman expatriate that's also profiled in the book. Her name is Roya Temuri, and she fled with her parents when the Shah fell. But she's very active now in attempting to destabilize the regime by publicizing, particularly women who get imprisoned. The worst of all worlds for them is when they get imprisoned because, you know, they get raped and it's horrific, and then they'll often get executed. So she publicizes various cases, and it's been effective in getting some of them released, and has a lot of contacts there now. And so I do believe that if the U.S. Were to take out the nuclear sites, I don't necessarily think we have a regime that will do that. But if we did, I think that it would be such a destabilizing event that the regime would fall as well.
I wonder if firearms are available to Iranian citizens. I'm thinking they're not.
No, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
That's what all tyrannies do is they disarm the citizenry.
And people over here just, a lot of people do, but a strident number of people do not understand this, will not embrace it, will not be swayed from their beliefs that all these firearms need to go. And it's just absolutely insane. You know, you have quite a touching dedication at the beginning of your book to your beloved wife and sons and the women of Islam murdered by their own relations, deposited in unmarked graves. That they be welcomed as saints by the one true loving God. That's a very interesting dedication. How did you come to decide that that was the dedication for this work?
In my conclusion to the final third of the book, I maintain that we need to engage in the war of ideas, so to speak. We cannot be docile in that and allow militant Islam to paint us with the brush of the infidel and the unbeliever and the evil unbeliever. We need to also call them out for their cruelty to women, for one thing. We've all heard about these honor killings. It's much more of a widespread phenomenon than anybody really wants to believe. If the readers go to the section where I profile these women, there's a woman by the name of Wafa Sultan, and she's a psychiatrist, a former Syrian, who describes what is kind of endemic to Islamic culture, and that's where the woman and her daughter come in to the she worked in a gynecologist's office, and the daughter and the woman come in, and the woman explains to the doctor they want to get her exam. They want to get vaginal exam so that they can ascertain that she is a virgin. But the woman will say, "Well, that my daughter had a very bad fall when she was younger." And so often what they find is not only has she been abused, usually by a family member, sometimes even her father, but that she may even also be pregnant. And so then the doctor will then tell them that in order to simulate virginity, it's going to cost a huge sum of money, which they come back the next day to the doctor's office, all covered up in their veil so that nobody will know, and having sold their jewelry and whatever, they raise the money. That's what happens to the middle and upper middle class women all over the Middle East. For those that the younger ones, for the the less fortunate ones, the poorer ones, they're just murdered, dumped into unmarked graves.
You know, a photographer that I know, I'm not going to even say who it is, just because you never can tell what it's going to lead to, that actually took my picture that I've got posted around, sunglasses and all that, you know, doing the man in black thing with the black tie, actually goes over to places like the Middle East, was in Afghanistan, teaching school children there for 2 years in Kabul. And then went to India recently. Now, I know we're not talking about India, we're talking about Iran. And primarily the Middle East. But in India, I was horrified to learn when I was told of burn centers. And these are, I said, burn centers? You mean like for people who are injured? And she said, no. These are centers that the women go to who have no dowry. And they are incinerated. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I said, you've got to be making this up. This is too horrible. Oh, no, I'm not making it up. I'm not making it up at all. This does happen.
Yeah.
And so to find out that, we go round and round about, women's rights here, keep your, I get all of that, I do. But when you consider what's happening to these nations, these nations, meaning these peoples that have been around for centuries and have had really high spikes in science, Dr. Bose is not a German. He's an Indian. And all the mathematics and mercantilism and everything else that came out of Persia, which is now Iran, it's absolutely extraordinary that things change as they do, because it appears that once a civilization falls, what it may turn into after the fall and when it is rebuilt is completely unpredictable, but usually not as good as what it had before. We'll be back for the last segment of our program tonight. Our guest is a first-time guest, Larry Kelly. Kelly with two E's. LarryKelly.com. His book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations. This is Coast. Thank you very much. Delighted to be in with you tonight at the end of a five-day, five-night stretch, sitting in for Captain George Norrie Tuesday through Friday, and then being able to be in the chair again tonight. This book, Lessons from Fallen Civilizations, is a survey of comparative history, which begins with the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC and covers the fall of the Greek police, Carthage, Rome, the Christian Middle East, Byzantium, and the Ottoman Empires. It demonstrates how immutable laws govern the fall of great civilizations and how these can be seen to repeat over time and are at work now. Above all, it is a story which chronicles some of the decisions, deeds, and heroics of our ancestors, which contributed to our enormously successful culture. It draws attention to those decisions we must make and the actions we must take in order to remain a free people. Or as Abraham Lincoln said, December 1st, 1862, we shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope on earth. Abraham Lincoln. Coincidentally, on February 12th, 2013, the President of the United States will place his hand upon the Lincoln Bible on Lincoln's birthday and be sworn in for a second term. Let us hope that our leaders can be revealed at some point in the near future to be working in our interests and will unite us, as Lincoln tried to do, rather than divide us. I think we have enough of that, don't you find? We'll be back with Larry Kelly in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Larry Kelly, who is Molly Norris?
John, thanks for asking. She is the my publisher and I, the Hugo House is my publisher, and I are setting up a foundation for her. She is the first American journalist forced into hiding by radical Islam inside the U.S. Our listeners might remember there was a Dutch cartoonist by the name of Kurt Westergaard who published some cartoons in a European newspaper, touched off riots and embassy burnings around the world. About 4 years later, the cartoon show South Park ran an episode, it was a comedy episode depicting Muhammad. The creators of that, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, received so many death threats that they ran the episode with a censored over the pictures of Muhammad.
Is this the one where he's wearing a bomb as a hat or something?
Yeah, that was a different cartoon. That was I think Molly Norris. She hearing of this, drew that picture. I think that was her picture, and she put up on her Facebook. She was a cartoonist working in the Seattle area. She worked for two magazines, City Arts and Seattle Weekly, and she put up on her Facebook, let's do a draw Muhammad Day. A fatwa was put out on her by a guy by the name of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was in Yemen. He was an American Yemeni guy who was killed by a drone. But he put out a fatwa. She got so many death threats that the FBI office in Seattle told her that they couldn't protect her and that she needed to go ghost their term. So she had to leave her friends, her livelihood. Nobody really knows how she gets by, even. Or even, I've contacted the FBI office. I've contacted both publications, and everybody's afraid to even provide a conduit. We're trying to get her some money. So the woman who did a lot of work on investigating her case is a woman by the name of Karen Lugo of Chapman University, who wrote, "Norris is the first casualty in the campaign to Islamify America."
When did this happen? How long ago was this?
This was in 2010.
Mm.
So for those that don't think that, the war is real or that we are at war or that we're in any danger, I'd like to add one other thing. Let me just say also, any book sale, we're going to set aside a small amount of money out of that book for Molly Norris, and we will find a way. So it's just a project that we're working on in conjunction with the marketing of the book. And I'd also like to say, too, that our listeners have probably seen Catherine Herridge if they watch Fox at all. She's the go-to person on Fox News that reports on internal terrorism inside the country. And in her book, The Next Wave, she maintains that the next attacks will be from indigenous Islamic citizens of the United States, and that right now the FBI is investigating a plot on average once every 2 weeks inside the U.S.
A plot of some significance.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so all this stuff about, well, the only ones that the FBI can bust are the ones that they set up. That's not entirely correct then, I suppose.
No. They'll typically try to get as much evidence as they possibly can, but there are times when these plots are broken up and it doesn't make the news.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's absolutely true. They're not unlike the CIA. They're known for their failures rather than their successes.
Very much so.
If we knew about every incident, we're hearing about that every day. It might be an entirely different thing. Now, one more time, who is that author and what is that book?
Catherine Herridge, and she's with Fox News, and it's called The Next Wave. And I quote it in the book, too, in my book. Mm-hmm. And you can get more information about it in my book. But, you know, I've summarized it in a sense.
You know, it was hard to predict at the beginning of this conversation that really the and we're coming down to the last, I don't know, 10 minutes, a little more. I'm hearing from everything from security services people to police, all kinds of sources, that the Muslim radical Islamic infiltration in this country is at a much higher level than anybody would suspect.
Yeah, that's my conclusion as well. And I have quite a bit on that in the book. But your readers will find out a good deal about that.
Let's jump over here to empowering allies in our war for survival. Empowering allies. Who are our allies, and how do we empower them?
Nobody who is knowledgeable about Islamic jurisprudence argues the fact that in Islam, apostasy is punishable by death. In other words, you leave the religion, that's a capital offense under Sharia law, which, by the way, is now going to be imposed in Egypt. But it's a body of laws that are, you know, the canon of Islamic jurisprudence. And the women who typically who leave Islam are also, you know, they have to fear for their lives. They need the support of the United States. I advocate that we should become a sanctuary country for Islamic women who refuse to be forced into, you know, marriages that they don't want, or that wish to leave the religion, or wish to date outside the religion. And if we do that, if we empower these people and we protect them, we engage in a very effective war of ideas, propaganda war, maybe is another way to say it. But I think that if the West doesn't do this, that we've capitulated in a form of appeasement. We need to put on notice that the principle that Pope Benedict came up with is that Islam needs to be forced, if you will, that there needs to be some kind of a reformation, if you will. And that can only be driven by the West.
Well, that makes perfect sense. You know what we haven't heard about in a long time is the mosque that was proposed right over by Ground Zero in New York City. You notice how these things are all the rage for a while, and then they just drop off the scope, and you hear no more.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was searching for the word. The Pope's word is reciprocity. That, in other words, that Islam should be held to the standard that we hold ourselves to.
So now, leaving the religion is a capital offense. Is that just generally, or to reiterate, is that just under Sharia?
Under Sharia.
Okay, but isn't there something that permits you to disguise yourself as long as you're working in furtherance of spreading Islam, where you can sort of deny that you are doing that and you're still in the clear?
Yeah, the difficulty that we have, that the West has always had, is that under, you know, the in the Quran and in the Hadith that depict Muhammad's life, it's maintained that lying to the infidel, if it is to further Islam, is condoned and encouraged.
Lying to the infidel. Oh, boy, I tell you. Well, take it anywhere you'd like to go from here on out. Just anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to, please get it out there, because there are lots of people listening.
Okay. Well, again, I just wanted to let everybody know that we are going to continue this, you know, crusade to try to get funds. We know we can find a conduit. It's just a matter of time to support Molly Norris. To publicize the fact that what most people wouldn't believe, that you know, a journalist inside the U.S. could be forced into hiding.
And the FBI is pretty sharp. When the FBI says, "Say, I don't think we're going to be of much help to you. You need to go ghost." That you're in some pretty deep mud at that point.
Yeah. Right. So. I guess, you know, in summary, too, I've written this book so that people can be empowered with understanding, you know, the threat that we face. And I would like to draw attention to one of my favorite expressions by H.G. Wells, and that is, people say, you know, are we doomed? I also say, as H.G. Wells put it, history has always been a race between knowledge and catastrophe.
Boy, that's a good one. That's a real good one. I understand that we're having some issues with Sharia law in American courts. It's unbelievable to me on, let's see. Looking at an article here from last summer. On May 21st, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback signed legislation prohibiting judges in the state from considering foreign law in their rulings. The law declares that any court decision will be considered void if it relies, quote, in whole or in part, on any foreign law, legal code, or system that would not grant the parties affected by the decision the same fundamental liberties, rights, and privileges granted under the United States and Kansas constitutions. The bill doesn't say Sharia law, but that's how it was marketed back in January of 2012 and all session long. And this Republican State Senator Chris Steiniger says he has the emails to prove it. And, you know, there have been all sorts of reports of all these numerous visits by CARE and the Council on Arab Islamic Relations and not Hamas, but Hezbollah. And also the Muslim Brotherhood, right up to the White House. Of course, I haven't seen the guest register, so I can't confirm this, but I can tell you that it's out in the news on a number of websites, and they're not like wacky, unreliable, you know, make something up and throw it out there like some we could name.
Yes, well, the Muslim Brotherhood differs from Al Qaeda in tactic, but not in its ultimate goal. Whereas Al Qaeda would like to, you know, attack us violently as much as they possibly could, the Muslim Brotherhood is they've never reversed their charter, which is to ultimately destroy the U.S. from within, to bring it under, you know, the black flag of Islam. So it's just, you know.
Quick question, Larry.
Just a fact.
What percentage do you estimate, just to make a guess, just an educated guess based on your research, what percentage of the total, the total Islamic nation, let us say, is radicalized to the point of wanting to overthrow us, overthrow our way of life, and just kind of take over, implement their ideology and remove ours?
Yeah, I have a... some information about the there was a study done on Islamic attitudes in the U.S. It's the most extensive one put together. I think it was in 2006, and they interviewed, I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was into the thousands of Muslims inside the United States. And one of the findings is that 5% of the American Muslims, when asked if they agreed with Al-Qaeda's tactics, you know, in the wake of 9/11, said they agreed with it. Another 20%, just under 20%, wouldn't answer the question.
Interesting. Chapter 6 here, it says, the modern Islamic threat and our 44th president. You have a couple of quotes here. First one is, we have a strategy drawn up for the destruction of Anglo-Saxon civilization. That's Hassan Abrasi, senior advisor to Khomeini, Iranian's supreme leader. And another one that is, Islam isn't in America to be equal to any other faith, but to become dominant. The Quran should be the highest authority in America, and Islam the only accepted religion on earth. That's Omar Ahmad of CAIR. That's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, he's not mincing words there exactly.
A front group for the Muslim Brotherhood.
Is that how it is? Is CAIR a front group for the Muslim Brotherhood?
Yeah.
Is that how you see it?
Yes.
Okay.
In the U.S., yes.
In the U.S. All right. Let's just toss this one out here just because we got a minute or so. You think that thing in Libya, that Benghazi attack, was in furtherance of pulling Libya into that vortex, that Muslim Brotherhood vortex? Because I understand some of the survivors there of that attack have, they haven't been exposed to any media spotlight. And, we still haven't had the secretary comment on it.
Yeah, there's conjecture that it was a, there was going to be a swap. Abdul Rahman is the guy who was responsible for the original World Trade bombing. Morsi, who, you know, is supposedly our ally, wants him released. He's considered a holy figure. And remember what the original bombing was aimed at doing. They were trying to topple one tower into the other. And they wouldn't have killed just 3,000. The estimates are up to 200,000.
Oh, man.
And so Morsi has said it, and so there's conjecture, and I don't have this on good authority, so I can just tell you what's out there.
Yep.
And that is,
do it quick.
That is that Obama was going to do the swap. He was going to allow one of our people to be captured, and then we would swap. We would get our person back. Right.
Yep.
And then
I get it.
In exchange for this guy, Rahman. I don't know.
We got to go, Larry. We got to bail right now. It's been a pleasure to have you on the program. Larry Kelly, LarryKelly.com, 2 E's and Kelly. This is John B. Wells signing off for now. I'll talk at you tomorrow. Well, no, I won't. I'll talk to you next Saturday. Bye-bye.